Well, while we're waiting first, I want to thank everybody for inviting me here. Like always, I've enjoyed the time. In fact, you notice that I'm an MD as well as trying to do research, and any time I can get in a situation where I can't be paged, I consider that a luxury. And most of my patients don't realize I'm in Toronto. I tried to set the minimum standard for my talk after the American newscast, which means it'll be high on glitz and low on content, or content-free, and I hope I can improve a little bit over that. What I'm going to talk about today is something a little different. I'm not going to do the multi-stability that Dr. Wu talked about in his talk yesterday. I was actually going to talk about another problem that I have become concerned about over the last 2 or 3 years. Most of this work is work that's either under review or still being thought about, so I will appreciate any help you might feel that you want to offer. Okay? But it's a problem that has come out of my long experience with chronic care patients. Just a review. Right now, Chicago is going through a long construction period on all of our roadways, and that's a sign that's everywhere in Chicago. And they finally agree with my point that you should always expect any physically realizable system that there are time delays involved. Okay, in Chicago, hours, but I'm going to talk about milliseconds. I got in a debate once with an NIH review committee who said there were no such things in the nervous system, and my answer to that committee was, if they don't, I'm out of a job. And what we do as neurologists, for example, is we might give you an electrical impulse of a little electrical current in your ankle over the sural nerve and measure how long time it takes to get to your brain, which is about 40 milliseconds. Or we might do the same thing at your wrist. It takes 20 milliseconds to get from there. And the way we localize pathology within the nervous system is by looking for delays. You know, if it from here it's 80 milliseconds, but we put the pulse there is only 22 milliseconds, we know that the conduction delay must be somewhere in here. So if there were no delays, I would be out of a job. Measuring this delay is very lucrative in the United States. That's $1,000 right there. Okay. A long way. The curious thing about when you start measuring this thing is the nervous system is set up in a totally different way than I would have thought of being set up. I imagine the brain as being one of the fastest, most powerful computers on the world. And I would imagine that everything up there works very quickly. But it's the opposite way around. Conduction delays and the conduction velocities in the peripheral nerves and spinal cord are of the order of meters per second, but they're only centimeters per second in the central nervous system. So it's actually slower up there than it is for the rest of your brain. And if you start looking at latencies versus conduction latency, the conduction latency is the time you would get if you just measured the length of axon that all the signals have to go on and take the conduction velocity, and the latency is what you would measure in the lab if you gave an input and you rate it for the response. The actual latencies are much, much longer than the conduction delays. And so we're looking at delays that get up into the half second situation. So our nervous system all the time is dealing with rather sizable delays. And the interesting thing about it is it really wants to get the information in there as fast as it can get it in there. And once it gets in there, it slows everything down for reasons I don't understand. Now this creates a problem, okay? This is a slide I show my students when I teach my introductory course to make the difference between a lag and a delay. Okay? But if you think about it, if I give my stimulus here, and this is as long as it takes before I can make a response to the nervous system, so I might feel something at my foot, and this is how long it takes to move my foot so I stop feeling the pain or something, what happened if a second stimulus came in here? How did the nervous system keep me functioning while I was waiting for the delays? How do I control things that are faster than the delay? Okay, and that's a major, major, major problem for the nervous system because we are bipedal. We are standing up like an inverted pendulum. We are an unstable system, and the nervous system is working to keep us balanced. It can't even afford this kind of delay. And this is the kind of problem I have become very, very interested in. How does the nervous system overcome the fact that there are these delays there? Here, just to remind you that if you have events that occur faster than you can make a response, the results are disastrous. You know, if they had have known within 2 minutes before this that this was going to happen, they still couldn't have done anything about it to do it, because that's how long it would have taken to scramble the jets up, get that little missile armed, somehow point it at the jetliner and blow it out of the air. So the same thing happens to us. If we're standing here and we get a perturbation, and we don't blow up and things like that, but we crash to the ground. And as a patient is concerned, that is a major cause of morbidity and mortality in the United States. Okay? So the other thing, of course, the nervous system not only has time delays, it has a noise in it. And so the question I asked with this little picture, if you were building a nervous system, are these obstacles or are these assets? Traditionally, we would have probably called these obstacles. The question mark goes with assets. Okay? I'm not going to have very many equations in this paper, but I have a few cartoons. This is a cartoon, and I apologize to the mathematicians, and I'm going to ask what appears right now to be a rather stupid question, but I'm going to ask it again at the end of the talk, and I wonder if you'll change your answer. All I've shown is a parameter space for some dynamical system. In here, if I chose the parameters to be inside this circle, okay, the system is stable. If I picked my parameters outside the circle, it's unstable. And I want to ask you, what would be the position that you would want to put the parameters so it would have the fastest response to correct the perturbation? Mathematicians, undergraduate math, I'd say, well, if I'm in here, the response to my perturbation is proportional to the real value of the eigenvalues, and especially if they're negative. The more negative I make them, the better it is. If I'm out here on the boundary, the real part of the eigenvalue is zero. So answer would be first guess here. If I pick in here with a delay system, I have to deal with my tau. Because I give it a response, it's going to have a dead time and length tau plus whatever the relaxation is to my fixed point. So there it is. I'm going to come back and say, maybe you might change your answer. Okay. First possibility. Okay, how does the nervous system control skilled movements, of which most of us do? Last night I watched a hockey game. That's a skilled movement that occurs faster than the time delay the nervous system has to correct everything. How does it occur? What our traditional answer in neurology is that the movements are actually pre-programmed before you do it. In fact, the concept is in neurology is if your brain can be think about the movement, it's the same as doing it. Okay? And we know a little bit about the anatomy. Here's two hemispheres of a representative brain. It's hopefully not mine. Okay? There is an area in the brain which is called the primary motor cortex, which means if you stimulate there, for example, if I stimulate it down here where your lip was, you might get a pull in your lip suddenly. Okay? It's like that cartoon I'm sure all of you have seen where the doctor is operating on the patient. They push, he's got his hand down there and the leg jumps up and the surgeon says, whoops. Okay? But in addition to this primary area, there are many, many, many areas of the brain. In fact, almost the whole brain is involved in planning and different aspects of movement and piecing it together. Okay? Even what is called primary sensory cortex, which is where you would think your sensation is, actually has a motor component. The difference between motor cortex and sensory cortex is the strength of the stimulus used to stimulate that movement. Okay, in other words, a smaller stimulus would make the lip move over here, but if I was over here and made the stimulus in the sensory cortex larger, I would actually get a movement of the lip. And so this whole dichotomy, if you want, between sensory and motor parts is quite confusing. What's important to remember is a lot of that data there is from monkeys. Okay, these are primate data, so we don't really know. The second thing is that the task that's being done is trivial. The typical task for doing these experiments is wiggle your finger. Is wiggle the finger the same as trying to hit a home run in the World Series? No. Is it the same as being a ballerina? No. Okay, so these are trivial movements, and what we really don't know about are skilled movements. Because if you wanted to know how the brain works the best it could possibly best, surely you'd go find the expert. You say, how does the expert do it? Then I'll go look at an amateur. And then, of course, I want to find a movement that means something to anybody. I don't think this means anything to the nervous system. It has absolutely no challenge to it. And if we weren't giving them the $50 to participate in the experiment, I don't think the person would even be in the room. Okay. So the answered question is, where are these skilled movements now? We're talking skilled movements programmed in humans. And are there differences in how it's done between an amateur and a professional? Lots of amateurs would love to know that question because they're going to make a lot more money here than they are over there. So the big question was to find a movement that you can do without moving. Okay? Because a lot of sports require you to pre-program the movement before you do it. But things like hockey, Wayne Gretzky racing down the ice, he is clearly pre-programming and moving at the same time. Okay? And the problem with all of our techniques to measure what's going on in the brain is they require the subject not to move. But there's one sport, actually three, archery and riflery are the two that have also been studied, but there's one sport in particular where a major part of the sport is a pre-planning phase in which the golfer remains absolutely stationary, and a second part where they swing the club. And so the question is now, the question we want to ask, of course, is while they're focusing on it, so obviously golfers become the perfect experimental animal for this experiment. This is a person, this is Ben Hogan for the non-golfers, the guy who spent his lifetime working on a perfect swing. This book, I just realized that there's some businessman in England many, many years ago brought together a group of about 20 scientists who were the best scientists in the nation, and they actually put together a really detailed scientific work. It's the only work in golf that is. Right now, there actually is a World Scientific Congress of Golf that meets every year. And a trick question, what university in the world has the second largest collection of golf books? And the answer is University of Chicago. Okay? So we have some interest in that. Here is the golf swing. I'm just looking at the downswing. So from the top of the club, for a reasonable amateur golfer, it takes 250 milliseconds to get to the down where you contact the ball. Okay? If you were at this point in time asked to move your thumb, if somebody said, move your thumb, okay, you would be able to move your thumb here 30 milliseconds before you hit the ball. If someone were to ask you to move a joystick beginning here, the joystick was moved sort of out here. And if somebody were to perturb your posture, so they would shake the ground just as you started your downswing, way over there somewhere is where you would have made a correction. So most of that golf swing cannot be corrected or adjusted once it begins, which is exactly what we want. So we have to pre-program that. Here's a picture. This is Ben Hogan himself. This is what golfers look like. Okay? If you go and you talk to professional golfers, people who are on the tour, who have won the, who are in the Hall of Fame, and ask them, what are you thinking about? They say nothing. It's interesting. What the heck does nothing mean from the neuroanatomy point of view? Why was University of Chicago interested in a study on golf? We're pretty esoteric. Leon knows the quote. Famous president of University of Chicago, whenever I feel the urge to exercise, I lie down until the feeling subsides. So we have historic rights to work on this problem. Excuse me? It's probably my mistake. It should be R. I'm sorry. Okay, so what we did is we set up the following experiment. The what? I'll tell you. Where did our projectionist go? She had the volume up. We had to wait. I don't know where the volume switch is.
I shouldn't touch these because I will.
Anyway, just to tell you. Let's see. This is from PBS. That's the logo.
There's another weekend visitors to Chicago who have been extremely welcome, namely women professional golfers. The LPGA Tour has stopped outside Chicago last month. That event gave researchers from the University of Chicago the perfect opportunity to begin a unique and important experiment. The women's clubs lent their wings to neural scientists to help them understand how adults learn complex skills like the golf swing. The findings may not be planned for a rehabilitation strategy for stroke victims and others with neurological damage. In this case, we can say it's not just a game.
How did this experiment come? There's no granting agency in the world that I know would have given us somewhere around $300,000 to do this experiment. This is what this experiment cost. We fluked out because my sister-in-law is an LPGA Tour professional who introduced me to Betsy Clark, who's the director of education and whatever for the LPGA for their teaching professionals. Okay, and through her, it turned out that in the summer of this year, which is the year 2000, the LPGA was in Chicago. And we got permission. Well, this is now the 160 best golfers, women golfers in the world. 80 of them do not make the cut on Saturday morning, and we were allowed to talk to those 80 players who did not make the tour make the cut on that day, which is an interesting thing because they're really emotionally distraught because they're not going to make several hundred thousand dollars, if they would be willing to come to the University of Chicago down. Okay. On the other hand, at University of Chicago had just bought a brand new fMRI machine, and given the problems of shipping and everything, that had not arrived around the time when the old one was to be turned down. And we had a month block of which the U.S. Open was sitting right in the middle. So the University of Chicago Brain Imaging Center was kind enough to give us the machine for this experiment. So that's how we fluked out. So we actually did the experiment with free. A number of people came. This next one. All around the country to help us.
Make it look so effortless. Swing the club, hit the ball. Yet that motion is considered the most precise motor movement we can attempt.
Probably the most difficult and highly precise movement that we actually do on this planet. And we have the techniques to actually get some insight into what's going on.
Science knows little about how the brain programs very rapid, highly skilled movements like the golf swing. At the University of Chicago, Dr. John Milton theorizes that if the part of the brain that programs those movements can be located, scientists may be able to identify better therapeutic strategies to rehabilitate patients with stroke or other neurological problems.
The easiest way to...
Now, the, next one.
The easiest way to understand is the downswing of the golf swing occurs so quickly that the nervous system can't control it while it's being done, and therefore has to pre-program it.
Chicago Symphony.
One of the ideas is that the highly skilled movements that are overlearned by the nervous system, like walking and standing and balance and maybe hitting a golf ball, are actually stored deep in the subcortical structures of the brain. When you have a stroke, the connection between the cortical, which is the thinking part of the brain, and these deep structures is actually broken. And so one of the reasons why a stroke person might not be able to do these tasks anymore is because they don't have the connection between their brain and where these things have actually been stored.
This idea comes from pigeons. If you ever look at the brain of a pigeon, the pigeon's brain is almost entirely basal ganglia. Okay, there's almost no cortex. So when you watch a pigeon walking along, you notice that they're extremely stereotyped in their movement because they're just using only pre-programmed movements with very limited ability to update them. Now what these golfers saw, having an MRI, how many people in this room have had an MRI study? Okay. I would describe it as putting your head inside a garbage can while people pounded on it for an hour. Would that be a pretty correct? Oh, those who get the head in. You're in about a 2.5-foot radius cylinder that looks like you're sitting inside some kind of cannon, and it makes an enormous amount of noise. And the golfers who were supposed to be sitting there had pictures taken at that golf club, which were all 100 yards, it's American, 100 yards from the thing, and they would be coming in random sequences, different holes and things like that. They're all the same distance, and the golfer is told, once you see this shot, okay, go through your pre-shot routine for a 100-yard shot to the green, okay? And then interspersed would be pictures like this, which also have an obvious vertical thing in it, and it could be a fire hydrant or whatever. And when they saw this picture, they were asked simply to fixate on this without planning a shot. Okay? So we're trying to correct for eye movements and visual things, because the way you do an fMRI is you find out what the brain activity changes were with this picture, and you subtract it from that one to find out what was the added part for the golf swing. Okay? And here, now, this was several terabytes. Is terabytes the thing amongst gigabytes of data? It took us 18 months to finish the analysis of the data. We did it all blindly, so we only realized 2 weeks ago what the code is. So nobody in the world actually knows the results of the study, but I'm going to share them with you today because you probably don't care, okay, or whatever. And so here were four golfers. We didn't know which one of those golfers, okay, and you can see these little red areas, and there's actually 30-some slices, so you can see all the way down, okay. Which one of those, and some of the golfers have lots of area of the brain lit up, and others not so much. So who was the amateur and who was the professional? Anybody got an idea? There are actually three amateurs and one professional on this slide. And these are the amateurs. And this is the professional. The professional doesn't light up very much compared to these guys. Okay, it's very interesting. So if you actually look at the data, and here it is, there's 9 tour professionals here, 9 women amateur golfers help recruit it through the teaching division. Regions of interest. There are, in each hemisphere, roughly 14 areas of cortex that scientists know are involved somehow in movement, other than the primary motor cortex. Okay, this number here should be 28, but it's really 27 because we didn't distinguish between the left and right side of the cerebellum. So when the amateurs do that task, they essentially almost light up every single area in their brain that's involved in motor control. In contrast, the tour professional lights up very few, in fact, exceedingly few in some cases. The other difference that you notice really quickly is that if you time the time it takes between an amateur before they hit the ball, okay, and time it repeatedly, you find out that it only takes 3 seconds in the variance, and that's a crazy number because it's really skewed to funny numbers, so that's a mistake there. But the point is that the variance is as large as, that should have been plus or minus 3. The variance is as large as the mean, so they can be anywhere from almost instantaneously when they see the shot out to 7 or 8 seconds away. But the professionals are much longer and almost not variable at all. In fact, the LPGA and the PGA publish data on every golfer that you see on Sunday afternoon, and they're all like this. Okay, so the tour professional, when the skilled performer requires less brain but takes more time to activate it. Yeah, it's all around the 12 second. You might have an 11.5. I sort of made up an average professional golfer one here just to put you the difference. There's a range from about 11 to 13 seconds. But every one of them would have that kind of variance stuck on it. So you could imagine there might be an 11 plus or minus 0.25. And these are incredibly precise. In fact, if you actually study these people very carefully, their respiratory rate slows. No, excuse me, their heart rate slows just before they hit the ball. They hit the ball in the same phase of breathing. And the EEG activity in the hemispheres completely equilibrates. So here we have a very, very complex task. If you could shoot a cannon as well as you could hit these professionals can hit a golf ball to the green, you wouldn't need smart bombs. So these people at 150, 175 yards under no pressure will probably put over 90% of their shots within like a 4-foot radius of the hole under all conditions. Okay, you don't realize how robotic these professionals are, but it's incredible that, so what's going on? So what is Tiger Woods really thinking about when he's staring about that? He's not using an awful lot of cortex. So the question you need to ask yourself is, what is the most important computational task? Notice I said computational, not behavioral. Most computational, important, performed by the nervous system. Okay, there's a 3-letter word that probably would have won if I had to put behavioral, for those who are so inclined. And I think it's balance. In fact, all textbooks think about it too. This is taken in my kitchen. That's the noise. That's a running faucet. And all I was trying to do is, if you watch here, I have obviously a tile pattern. And I've taken a video camera and I've closed my eyes. And that what you find in those vibrations are my postural sway. Okay, so randomly when I'm trying to stand still, like you might imagine, since it's unstable, I'm making these little things. The time delay to make a correction here is 200 to 500 milliseconds. I just showed you. The time delay to complete a corrective movement. So this one up here is just, I get a perturbation to the time that I actually begin to make a movement. This one here is I've actually got to complete it. It's almost as big as a second. Okay, and it's probably not surprising when you have these unpredicted perturbations going on here that falls are a major cause of patient morbidity and mortality. In fact, the number one factor that limits us in rehabilitation of patients with neurological disease is they can't maintain balance. So you can't get them to walk. I always tell my patients, I have a golf neurology clinic, you can't hit a golf ball when you're lying on your back. Okay, it's just a simple fact. So the question is, now the other thing is that if that's the most complicated thing we can think about, the most overpowering computational task, it seems to be incredibly inefficient. The nervous system would spend every resource it's got in there doing it. Okay? You could argue, for example, maybe what the professional golfers are doing and why their cortex is not involved, because all the other balance mechanisms are in the spinal cord and the muscle loops and all this sort of stuff. But if you're using up all of this computation for just that one task, how can there really be very much left over to think about other things? You sort of would just be a remote moving kind of thing, trying to think. So the question is there really another possibility here? Is there another way to stabilize a system and overcome the time delay that doesn't require a lot of computation? Okay? Here's a task that should be familiar to all of you. I think I have my, I was going to have a stick. All of you know if you try in your office or at your desk when you're really, really bored, if you try to balance a pencil at your fingertip, a regular pencil, you can't do it. Okay? But if that stick becomes longer, let's say longer than 30 centimeters, most of you can keep it up for a long time. Okay? The reason, the explanation that's typically given for the fact that you can do this is that as the length of the pencil increases, okay, its rate of movement slows and eventually gets slow compared to the time delay in the nervous system to make a corrective movement. Okay? But of course, even in these kinds of patients, this kind of experiment, there's a lot of variation in people's ability to do this. And in fact, the pencil will eventually fall sometime. Okay? Now, mathematically, if you put, you imagine an inverted pendulum, instead of describing it with an ODE, which means it has no stable solution in the upright position in the absence of noise, or of little fine sinusoidal you can stabilize it, of course, by vibrating underneath it in the plane very, very high frequency. Okay? When you have an equation that has delayed feedback in it, there is, in fact, the possibility of a stable fixed point. In fact, there's probably the more likely a possibility of a stable limit cycle. That's what Sue Ann Campbell and her colleagues at her university have shown. Okay, so there is something stable up there, but what actually is the entity is not clear. Now, what I want to point to, if you look at this stick, this is we have dowels made about every material you can imagine, because as we change the length of the dowel, we want the mass to remain constant, which means you have to get into all kinds of hardware catalogs and have ridiculous arguments about if I want one. They want to sell you 1,000 dowels made of such and such a material, and you want one. It's a big argument. These little things are little reflector balls on the end, and what we actually have here are two infrared cameras, which are designed to send out infrared light and reflect back. Each camera has its own computational device inside and can compute the XY recordness of that, and they triangulate together to give you X, Y, and Z for that point. The cameras we use have the ones we use the most have a 4 millisecond resolution in time. We also use ones that have 1 millisecond resolution in time. Higher the resolution, the more expensive they get. And the spatial resolution is about 0.05 millimeters. So we're talking about very precise dynamics when this lady does this thing. And here's the very first experiment. What are we measuring here? We're measuring the angle from the vertical displacement angle. Okay? And what you notice, this is actually two different stick lengths. What you notice, so here, there's a couple things you should notice. First, the vertical displacement angle is always fluctuating. Sometimes it makes little fluctuations, sometimes it makes big ones. Sometimes it makes really big ones. The second thing is it doesn't really fluctuate around the vertical. It's off a little bit. Okay? We think the fact that it's off a little bit means there's a little low amplitude limit cycle there, but we're not sure. If you now put a threshold, and for example, there's a threshold, and there's a whole range of places where you can put a threshold, and you measure the time between successive crossings. Okay? And this is because I have Juan Luis Cabrera with me, who happens to be very interested in parametric noise and all the phenomena that goes on there. And now you made a plot of the probability that the crossing was a certain value, okay, versus the logarithm of that value. You get a line. So you get a scaling relationship. And the slope of that line, in fact, that solid line there, is -3/2. Okay, and if you're in the world of something called on-off intermittency, okay, there is a kind of on-off intermittency which has to do with stochastic forcing of a parameter across the stability boundary. Okay, so in this experiment, we wonder if that's the phenomena that's going on. This is the thing we've been working on. Where is the time delay in this experiment? It's over here, 250 milliseconds. So more than 90% of these fluctuations occur fast compared to the time delay. This is not a phenomena that can go with additive noise. This is purely a multiplicative noise phenomena if that scaling law is like that. The second thing you observe, okay, so here is what's happening and then the pencil finding thing. If you did the power spectrum of that, okay, and looked out here on this high frequency and now made it a log-log plot, you find that this area here has a slope of -1/2. Which is the theoretically predicted slope for the power spectrum in on-off intermittency. But the additional feature is there's a little peak in the power spectrum right here. If you assume that that peak frequency is 1/2 tau, which is a reasonable guess, a first approximation that it might be related to the delay and things, you would estimate that tau should be around 250 milliseconds. which is in agreement with the experimentally determined value of the delay. Okay, so there it is. Okay, that's... A long ways away, what happens is the statistics fall off. We don't have enough points. So if you were to make your thresholds down here, what happens is you start getting limited by the number of data points you have. And it's really, really hard. The experiments I'm going to show you took some poor guy a month of several hours a day doing this experiment just to get the statistics where we're sitting right now. Okay, I'll show a little bit more about that. But as long as you pick your thresholds in this area where you've got enough statistics to make the decision, you always get this. Okay. I'm going to go to that at the end of the talk. Okay. Okay. So now we were going to try to do a numerical simulation of this because this is one thing we thought we did. So we would say, well, we'll just take a second-order delay equation, okay, and we're going to put on it a feedback that has a time delay in it and a coefficient in front of the a parameter in front of that feedback which has noise inside, so parametric noise. Notice we put signs in here. Well, thanks to Sue Ann Campbell, because we suspect there was probably a low amplitude limit cycle up there, Sue Ann Campbell told us that you had to have at least the expansion of sine to x to the seventh. So we decided not to mess around with that, and we just simply put sine in there. All these parameters here, the delay, we spent time, I can tell you, I can't remember the number, but I know what the damping coefficient is for the little stick falling in the air. We measured that. We know the masses. We know the lengths. We know the gravitational constant. So all the parameters are known, but we really don't know R, and we know nothing about what really the noise is. Okay. You can certainly make, now what you do is you adjust R. You know roughly where the stability boundary is. We have very low amplitude multiplicative noise or low intensity multiplicative noise, so we assume that with the parametric system, the stability boundary is close to where it is. It may not be exactly the same, but close to it, okay? And you adjust the R now so you come out close to that stability boundary, okay? And you get the same kind of looking trajectories that you would get. Okay, if you do the power spectrum there, you get a power spectrum that has slope minus 1 over 2. I didn't know how to do fractions in Word. And you have a peak up there that's related to the delay. Okay, okay, here's our attempts to get the scaling law right. Okay, and what I want to tell you, and these are just offset. First, this is wrong. This should be 10 to the 0, 10 to the minus 1, 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 3. So multiply that bottom axis by 10 to the minus 5. I didn't notice that until this morning. This is, I think, something like 2 weeks of computer time on a very, very fast machine to try to get the statistics. And this is like a month to try to get it. So it's very, very slow converging. Right here, the slope is minus 3 over 2. Okay, and the delay is here. So most of the corrections, there are corrections that are occurring faster the delay. But the curious thing is, and this is the part that disturbs me, what's the value of R? Okay, if I make R a little bit towards the stability regime by, let's say, one part in 10 to the minus 0.0001 deviation, but towards the stability, I just get a stable point. Okay, if I move it that same distance on the other side, the thing is unstable. So what I'm trying to tell you is to numerically reproduce the experiment that I just showed you, I look like that I have to essentially put the point on the boundary. This is the R, the parameter value. So I have to pick the parameter so I'm essentially on the boundary. Okay, if I move to the inside of the boundary, it simply sucks itself into the stable fixed point. If I move it just on the outside of that boundary, it goes unstable. So to duplicate the experiment with this particular model, and of course you can argue there are a million times problems may be in the model, but it's certainly the simplest choice. It is curious to me that I have to pick the point right on the boundary. Okay. Now, the thing I had thought about when I was writing up the talk before I started thinking about this more, I said, well, if you think about it, there's a nice thing about on-off intermittency in this experiment. A nice thing is what's the most probable crossing times if the thing really follows that scaling law? Well, it's about zero. Okay. What's the most probable, what about the velocity of your hand movements? Well, they're certainly finite. Most people cannot go, which means that the most probable displacement from the vertical angle is zero. So it's like a statistical kind of stability, but why would you still want to be out there in the boundary? And so the question I'm going to put a conjecture is the answer to this question I started off with. Sure. Whoops. Wrong way. Okay. Now what happened? I'll find it in a minute. Just give me a second. Yeah, that's the question. We don't know exactly how to count it. I was just sort of trying to tell you if the delta x was supposed to be nearly zero and delta v is very small, nearer to zero, does that mean that delta t is almost zero, delta v is almost zero, so delta t times delta v equals delta x, so delta x is almost zero. No, not yet. Still working on that one. Okay, so that's why I put conjecture up there. Don't really know. I've now learned from the numerical analysis people there are all kinds of problems trying to do a simulation right on the stability boundary with noise. Okay, so there's my conjecture. So the question is that you begin to wonder about if all that mathematics is, does the nervous system really use or learn to use noise to control skill movements, which is really weird, I think. Okay. My eyesight's not that good. I just want to introduce the concept of a Levy distribution. Okay. We'll come back to this graph in a minute, but this will be sort of like a Gaussian distribution, okay? And the difference between a Levy distribution and that is that the Levy distribution has large tails, so it can make very long, very small, or very fast correction. This is a distribution in velocity. What we're measuring is the velocity change, the delta v's. So at each time step in things, we estimate what the velocity is there, and we're telling you what the velocity changes. See, it's sort of proportional to the force, okay? What have I shown you on this picture? This is a month of somebody doing this experiment. Each day, they are doing about 4 or 5 hours of pencil balancing, which gives us enough data to get enough crossings to estimate this sort of thing. Okay? This part here, okay, is the first 2 weeks. Okay? This part here is the last 2 weeks. Okay? The difference between this curve and this curve is overnight. Okay? When the person was doing the experiment for the first 2 weeks, his average time, it's Juan Luis's. Also, I have two ladies that did the same thing. I'll show you their picture. Their average ability to keep the pencil this particular length up was about 20 seconds. When they move over here, it's now 4 or 5 minutes. Okay. Once they have learned to do this, made this transition in a particular stick length, they transfer it to all other sticks. The nervous system clearly has made some sudden change right here, okay, in its behavior. Okay, it really is Levy, you know, because if you, for example, the way to get the exponent in the Levy, that little alpha, is you measure your data at different sampling intervals, okay, and a plot of the probability of the zero value, okay, should linearly, in a log-log plot, the slope of that should be 1 over alpha, okay, and you so this is going from 1 milliseconds up to 16.67 milliseconds, 16, well, is that right? Yeah, I think it's around 60 hertz that this is. So you get a beautiful straight line. You find that coefficient is 1.65. So you can go back and fit that curve and show it really is 1.65. Okay? If you watch her hand, you can actually see it. She makes lots of little corrections and every once in a while, a big one. Okay? If you want to prove this to yourself and you don't want to spend many hours trying to learn how to balance a stick, stand on one leg with your eyes closed and you can feel it. You make lots of, you're perfect, and then, you make a big one. Okay? So what's happening is in the way of the skill, okay, someone is learning to make very fast corrections or big, larger corrections, more reliable or better, and therefore it ends up being a better performance. I should say that the one thing that did not change over that month of experiments is it always was on-off intermittency if you looked at the tip of the pencil. Okay, the scaling law was exactly the same, so that part didn't change. It's the hand that's moving. These Levy distributions, which people talk about normally in stock markets and things like that, are actually becoming very important in the nervous system because we know, for example, that albatrosses, when they search through their prey, have a search pattern that can be described as a Levy distribution. People, when they read sentences in books and things like that, if you scan their eye movements, the movements of the hand actually follow a Levy distribution, and neurobiologists wonder if that is the most efficient search pattern that you can have. These are the people who have helped me, all different kinds. These are the people with the LPGA. Debbie Cruz is a well-known researcher area who won the Science Prize in golf last year. Okay, these are my students. Here are the two ladies that did that experiment for day on day on the summer. They would call themselves the ladies who balance the stick at the finger. They made themselves a secret society. They really liked doing the experiment because we had it set up in a competitive way. They really knew as we were doing the experiment that we needed the data to get the statistics, and therefore there was a real reward to be able to balance it a long time. Okay, and so they had a competitive part about it, and so they're really, really trying to do this the best they can. And I think that's why they succeeded. We're actually going to get some acrobats over the summer who have been professional in this and ask if there's another solution beyond what these ladies got. I mean, this lady here, as you saw her, she is incredible. She can keep pencils up that most of you in the room would keep up for about 20 seconds. She can keep them up for a very long period of time. Okay, and this is what's it about. Okay, all here's patients, not necessarily all from my clinics, but people around the world who have disabilities just to want to play golf. As I said, I don't know what the exact interpretation of everything I showed you in the last part really is. I have a problem. I know the nervous system wants to try to overcome these delays. If it pre-programs it, as you get more and more skilled, it's not clear how you actually do this. We don't know anymore. The areas that the professionals are lighting up are not the same areas. Despite my bold claim on the TV, okay, it is absolutely clear that the basal ganglia are not involved with professionals. Okay, that's the one area of the brain that does not get lit up. Okay, and whether it is really true that you get a faster response in some sense by being on one of these stability boundaries rather than somewhere else, I leave for people like Haken and all of you guys to tell me the answer. Thanks very much.